And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
A perfectly good brain wasted.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara County. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is fundamental issues for our country. Each of my guests is discussing something vital to our national interest, health care, education, or employment. My next guest defied the odds. He grew up in Teaneck, not Hackensack, New Jersey. He got good grades. He was enrolled in engineering school at an Ivy League university. When he got the call, he was drafted into the major leagues by the Chicago Cubs. We'll discuss his major league career and the importance of getting good grades and finishing your education. If you want to join in the conversation, or if you just want to call in and talk to Doug Glanville, you can call us at 639-0008. Doug Glanville has always been an overachiever. He was drafted in the first round by the Chicago Cubs to play center field while he was enrolled at the University of Pennsylvania engineering program. He successfully juggled his budding baseball career with finishing his degree. Doug played 9 major league seasons with the Chicago Cubs, the Philadelphia Phillies, which, by the way, was his favorite team when he was growing up, and he finished his career with the Texas Rangers. After baseball, he's kept busy, part of his overachieving personality, I suppose. He was written a popular column for the New York Times, headed home, and then he served on the executive board for Athletes Against Drugs. He was a baseball analyst for XM Radio. Now he is an analyst for ESPN, and he advises high school athletes as a special consultant to the Baseball Factory. Doug and his family live in the Chicagoland area. Joining us from there, hi, Doug, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing well. How are you?
I am doing great. Thank you so much for returning and being my guest 1 year after your first appearance on the show. Thank you so much for that. So let me set the stage, if I can, for you. This weekend, it's going to be murder in my household. No peace at all, because I'm a Cardinals fan, and my wife is a Chicago Cubs fan. And, of course, you know, this is the weekend the Cubs and the Cardinals play each other in St. Louis. So there's no peace in the family whatsoever. You came up with the Cubs, though. You were quite the phenom when you came up with the Cubs. My wife remembers you, and she remembers your playing career with the Cubs. What was it like playing for Chicago and playing at Wrigley Field?
Well, you know, it's always exciting, just the idea of even just getting to the big leagues. But I was a Chicago Cub, and that meant my debut would be probably in the hallowed cathedral of Wrigley Field. So I can't imagine it getting much better than that in terms of being in this intimate environment that has this legacy, this history. So I was, a huge baseball fan growing up, and just to be a major league player inside the stadium, and then seeing my name in the lineup with, you know, Mark Grace, Ryan Sandberg, and Sammy Sosa, it was surreal, to say the least.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it must have been phenomenal playing with these guys. But tell me about the legacy of the Cubs. I mean, when you walk into the clubhouse, are you just sort of indoctrinated with the Cubs' history, or whatever team you're playing for, whether it's Philadelphia, Texas, are you indoctrinated with their history and what it's like to be a member of that particular team, or is it just another job?
No, there's definitely a history. I mean, I think that's the beauty of baseball. It's a constant flow of this generational connectivity that we have. We look back and we can have the same conversation in the 50s as you can in 2010 about what you think of the stolen base or different aspects of the game. And when you play Major League Baseball, you go through the organization coming up piece by piece. And in my case, you know, I hit every level, A-ball, AA, AAA. And by then, you're very familiar with a lot of the legacies of the organization, particularly coaches that have come back, and, you know, Ryan Sandberg, guys that have stayed in the organization that had played historically. So you're always aware of where the organization is coming from. And what's so special about baseball, each city, each stadium, each organization has its own story.
Without a doubt. And every city has its own culture around baseball as well. I've had the good fortune to see a baseball game in Wrigley Field. I know how the Chicago Cub fans are. Some of the most loyal fans in all of baseball. They have to be, because they haven't won a world championship since 1906 or 1907. But I've also been to Philadelphia, which I found were some of the harshest baseball fans that I've ever seen. I would argue perhaps the harshest. They really took it out on not only the opposition, but they also took it out on their own home team as well. What's it like playing in front of the home fans when you are with one of these major league teams? What's sort of the interaction that you felt with the fan?
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the uniqueness of the game. Each fan interaction, each city had its own flavor. You know, the Cubs fans, when I first came up, were very positive, and, hey, you know, that's okay. I know you lost 8 in a row. We got your back. But as I got older, as I get older, that changes a little bit because we sort of 2003, we had the expectation we were very close to winning, and
yes.
I think it became a little bit more edgy. But generally, you know, the loyalty is there. They've been through a lot, and certainly have not been able to bring home that championship in a while. Now, Philadelphia, it was a homecoming of sorts because it was a team I grew up in. I also went to college in Philadelphia, and I was traded there in December of 97. So Philly had this sort of, I always knew it had an edge, and it was they were going to be let you know if they're not satisfied with your performance, but they were itching for a winner. And when they finally got that 2008 ring, no better place to be.
No, without a doubt, they let you know if you were not performing. Mildly put. We're talking to Doug Glanville. We're talking about his major league career. He's just recently published a book or republished a paperback version of it, The Game From Where I Stand. A lot of great stories contained in that book, Doug. Now, you just mentioned the move that you made from Chicago back home, as it were, to Philadelphia. One of Ventura's own, Lenny Dykstra, was played on the Philadelphia team. So tell us about your relationship with Lenny Dykstra when you moved over to the Phillies, because you guys played the same position.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Lenny was a legend. I mean, his nickname Nails, so you knew he was a tough character. He also was a New York Met, so growing up in Teaneck, New Jersey, I was familiar with his career, and I was not a fan at the very least. So, so all of a sudden, I get traded over to Philadelphia, and now I have to compete with him to try to win the center field job. And I was told in the offseason, oh, he'll never make it back. He's got this back thing, and it's probably done. But, you know, don't worry about it. It's your job. And then all of a sudden I get to camp, and he's in the batting cage looking like he's in mid-season form. I'm like, well, wait a minute. What happened to this guy that's, like, on the shelf? So I had to really fight for my job, and eventually at the end of the spring, he struggled a little bit. His health had deteriorated, and he decided to retire. So I ended up becoming the starting center fielder. But the Philly fans still remember Nails.
Uh-huh.
Even though I was a Penn guy, an alumnus, I went to struggle the first few weeks of the season. So one of the fans caught wind of that I did my thesis on building a stadium at 30th Street Station in Philadelphia. So I had this big project in college. So that one of the fans yelled at me with my 170 batting average and said, hey, Glanville, why don't you design a stadium you can hit in? So that didn't really welcome me in. But that was Philly. They were hardcore. But eventually I think I ended up on the better end of things, and we had a very good relationship.
Well, that's a great story, one of the many great stories in Doug Glanville's new book, The Game From Where I Stand. Doug, you hold the distinction of not only being an Ivy Leaguer, but you were the first African-American Ivy Leaguer to play in the major leagues. So congratulations to you on that. Two-part question. First of all, how important was your education to you? And then secondly, how being an engineer by trade, did that impact how you played baseball at all? How you played the angles, the force of the bat, hitting the ball, anything like that? Did you put any practical knowledge from your engineering degree to work in your job at baseball?
Well, no, it definitely all connected. I mean, my education was central. I mean, my parents were both educators. My father ended up in psychiatry for many years. And, you know, they were the first generation to go to college in their family. So it was very central to be making sure you were well-rounded and had other things. Because even if you have a wonderful career in Major League Baseball, you know, you're 30, 34 years old, you're retiring, and you got to think of the next phase of your life. So I definitely felt it was important to have that as part of my life. And then certainly the engineering side was one of my passions. I love applied science and baseball was a numbers game, so there was a lot there that I had tried to connect. But the only thing I will say this is I tried to use baseball as more of a place I could be blank and relaxed and not think so much. You know, that was my escape. So I didn't want to sit there and calculate the probability of the guy throwing a curveball, but I did, you know, try to use my discipline in engineering to help me prepare for my opponent, which is, you know, a huge part of the game.
Yeah, that's true. We're talking to Doug Glanville. Doug, you know, we got to approach the sensitive subject of steroids in baseball. Now, when I grew up and was really, really following baseball, it was Sammy Sosa of the Cubs, who was a contemporary of yours, and Mark McGwire. They were battling it out for the home run championship, and it actually captivated all of the United States as they were going at it head to head. Later on, though, we come to find out that there's steroid use involved in baseball. Were you ever exposed to steroids? What are some of the stories that you have and you remember from your playing career all around steroid use?
Well, you know, I certainly heard wind of the idea even back in probably the mid-90s when I first got to the major league roster in spring training, and you kind of heard rumors. But it was always just whisperings in the dark. You didn't feel like it was like, okay, this is front and center, other than your sixth sense for what you thought was possible on a baseball field. Mm. And that always told you when a guy hits the home run and he hits it across the street and breaks the window 500 feet away, something is wrong here.
Yeah.
But that's not enough for a court of law, and you kind of felt like you were on your own and just sort of dealing with it. So most of the times you turn inward and you just worry about your own performance. But it definitely took shape and took over the culture of the game, which became much more power-driven, offensive-driven. But it was a dirty little secret. It wasn't guys. I didn't see people shooting up in the locker room or anything like that, but we knew it was an issue based on the numbers, the statistics, the size of these guys, and some of the health issues that came along with it. So and the game was lagging behind and figure out how to handle it, what was legal, not legal. And it took a lot of catching up to finally get to a policy that has some teeth in it that it does today.
Well, let me ask you how it affected you personally, though, because here you are. You have that sixth sense, as you just put it, about guys that are knocking it out of the ballpark, that there might be something a little unnatural there. But doesn't that put the pressure on you as a player who's not using steroids to say, gosh, how am I going to keep up with this person or people who are using steroids? I mean, there's a certain amount of pressure just to keep your job. How did that play into effect in your psyche?
Well, it's very difficult because, for starters, the most players are in a situation where they, don't have this other degree to fall back on. And that's, you're all in. And when you're all in, people do desperate things because they see a wonderful career falling and fading away to the wayside. And you have this inordinate amount of pressure to produce. And if the person competing directly with you, which it's not necessarily the guy in the other dugout, it might be the guy in your dugout.
Exactly.
You have to, live up to it. And so you feel that he's doing something, I got to keep up. There's a lot of guys that fall prey to that type of pressure. And so, the rewards are huge, but they're also finite in a very short period of time. And I always say that, there's no pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. The pot of gold is during the rainbow. The rainbow at the end is when you crash into the brick wall of a life transitioning out of a game that's all you know. And I feel that it becomes central to the anxiety and fear, which inspires a lot of people to find any way to hold on, as opposed to sort of what we kind of come to associate started as like a greed and a reward-breaking type of thing. It was, I think it had a lot to do with the insecurity of the career when everybody's trying to take your job. And so as a player who was affected directly, my salary probably changed. How I was measured against like personnel changed because all of a sudden the home run was king, and now center fielders like my position had to hit home runs. There's no question that it had some impact on the longevity of my career, but I just never thought that was something I was interested in going down that road. I felt like I had other wonderful options, and I feel like there's a huge spiritual loss, so to speak, and cutting corners by taking drugs because you don't learn how to cope with anything. And pretty soon you're going to have to face it no matter what. And you've just sort of foregone all skills and development and experiences to empower you with it.
Very well said. My guest is Doug Glanville, author of the book, The Game From Where I Stand. Doug, just one more question and I'll get off the roids, as it were. Should the guys who are known to have taken steroids be allowed into the Hall of Fame?
Well, on a pure level, if I had a vote and I said, I know this guy took steroids, I would not vote for him. I would not support him in getting into the Hall. Now, that being said, there's so much we don't know. There was guys that got caught. There's a lot of guys that probably didn't get caught. And probably the guys who did get caught probably know the other guys that didn't get caught,
sure,
that they probably could throw out under the bus. So it's a very slippery slope. And we don't have, unequivocal, just evidence to say, yeah, this is the steroid group and this is not. And that's part of the challenge. I think the game, we're going to need time and some sort of retrospective to see where it fits in the landscape of history and then try to figure out how to, sort of adapt accordingly. But, I certainly feel it's a dark time in the game. I don't think drugs were ever outside of the sport. There was always the red juice and the cocaine era and the, amphetamines. There's always been something in a hyper-competitive environment that people try to find an edge. I think this was the era where generations of history got blown out of the water, and I think that became even more offensive to people as they wanted to have this common language of talking about what happened in the 30s as opposed to the 70s and feel like they were speaking the same language. Steroids kind of blew that completely out.
An interesting perspective. My guest is Doug Glanville. Doug, you've been many things. You've been an engineer, trained as an engineer, ball player, an author, and also you've been involved in sports casting. Tell me about your new gig with ESPN.
Well, you know, I'm enjoying it. I wasn't exactly looking for it. I mean, I love to write, and the New York Times was going well. It led to this book, and I was still cruising on that, and I had a chance to interview, and I went in kind of cold turkey. And, you know, it's been a wonderful experience because it's a place where I feel like ideas come to life. There's a lot of platforms. They're very diverse. They run with things, and there's a lot of niches for you to find. So I'm still sort of navigating. It's my second year, and I'm trying to find my spot, but you know, I'm working on the so-called Baseball Tonight a lot, and it's been really rewarding to be able to analyze the game from this perspective. I kind of feel it's a good fit for me to because my niche is much more the human side of the game. It's sort of relevant in the context of the social umbrella of our society. I feel like that's a big place because it crosses over into everyone's life and it puts a bigger face on it.
It absolutely does. We've been talking to Doug Glanville, author of the book, The Game From Where I Stand, from batting practices to clubhouse to the best breakfast on the road, an inside view of a baseball player's life. Doug, if people want to learn more about you, they like your stories, they want to learn more, where would you direct them to go on the internet?
Well, I'm out there. Definitely DougGlanville.com is the spot, but I'm on Twitter, which is at Doug Glanville, and Facebook, all the usual suspects, and but you can email me even directly. I answer my mail, and I love to, you know, hear and get feedback about their thoughts and particularly about my writing. And I love to talk shop, so anytime, any place.
All right, Doug. Well, it has been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.